is Linda Lazat. I'm the co-founder of Designs for Health, nutritionist, and I'm happy to interview Dr. Nicholas Hedberg tonight. Let me tell you a little bit more about his background. Dr. Nicholas Hedberg, he's a DC, he's a DABC, he's a board-certified chiropractic internist by the American Board of Chiropractic Internists. His practice is in Asheville, North Carolina, where he focuses on Lyme disease. Matter of fact, if that's a topic of interest to you, go into the library at www.designsforhealth.com, and if you put in Lyme or H-E-D-B-E-A-R-G, it'll bring up Dr. Hedberg's other calls. He is fantastic, so you're going to want to go back and listen to those if you missed them. So thyroid disorders and autoimmune diseases, Dr. Hedberg is the author of the book, The Thyroid Alternative, which is a comprehensive guide to diagnosing and treating thyroid disorders. It's sitting right here next to me. It's fantastic. Dr. Hedberg lectures at integrative medicine conferences, has been published in medical journals, and teaches advanced functional medicine courses through Functional Medicine Town, and as an adjunct faculty member at Hawthorne University. Healthcare practitioners of all disciplines consult with Dr. Hedberg on their most difficult cases. His practice philosophy can be summed up by this quote by Sir William Osler: "It is much more important to know what sort of a patient has a disease than what sort of a disease a patient has." Wow, very good. Okay, we're getting started, so thank you, Dr. Hedberg.
Thanks for having me again, Linda. Really appreciate it.
And again, the book, The Thyroid Alternative, Renew Your Thyroid Naturally. He's got some nice write-ups in here by some doctors that we know. We have Dr. David Brady forward. He's got a really nice write-up by Dr. Daniel Kalish, chiropractor who's been on clinical rounds. Dr. Ernest Cohn, and who's the clinical director of Holistic Medical Clinic of Carolinas. And Dr. Jeffrey Moss from Massachusetts, that a lot of you know so well. So, fantastic book. It's definitely, we're going to go through a lot of what's in there tonight. Obviously, book is more patient friendly, and I know that was difficult for Dr. Hedberg to do, as it is for any of you practitioners trying to explain this to patients. But that's where this book might be really useful to you, because you're trying to explain the same stuff. So get the book, and if it's something that you're trying to explain to your patients on a regular basis, you can just hand it to them, and you don't have to explain it all, explain it 100 times. So, all right, so I know that that's probably why you wrote the book, Dr. Hedberg, no?
Yeah, you know, it's there's some good thyroid books out there, but I wanted to give a broad overall picture of functional medicine and all the different causes of thyroid disease, because a lot of people, the feedback I've gotten already is they said, wow, I never even knew that, you know, the adrenals can affect the thyroid and the Lyme disease can cause thyroid problems. So it's I think it's doing a good job educating people about thyroid disorders.
Yes, and we're going to learn some new things, and I learned some things, like you just mentioned, that I wasn't really up on before. So I would love for you to start with some of the statistics that you state in the book, and you have some great information about autoimmune thyroid disease that probably would make a good start to all of this.
Right. You know, now is the best time to be a functional medicine practitioner, because autoimmune disease is on the rise, and we're really the only ones who can identify why it's there and really get these patients under control and improve their quality of life. Autoimmune thyroid disease, it's the number one autoimmune disease in the United States. Actually, about 10% of the U.S. population has autoimmune thyroid disease. So it's a huge number of people. You know, almost one out of every 10 people you run into is going to have it. 27 million Americans, mostly women, about 50% of them will go undiagnosed. And 90% of the hypothyroidism you're going to see in practice is actually due to Hashimoto's. So, you know, when you see someone and you think that they have a thyroid problem, there's a good chance there's going to be autoimmunity involved. And conventional treatment, it's the same whether you have autoimmune thyroid disease or not. If you have just hypothyroidism that's non-autoimmune, you know, you get medication, Synthroid. If you have Hashimoto's, it's the exact same treatment. And that's why a lot of conventional physicians, they don't run thyroid antibodies because it's not going to change how they treat it. And we know that when someone does have Hashimoto's, it's not necessarily an issue with the thyroid gland. It's really an issue with the immune system.
Mm-hmm. Good point. So I do want you to go into that a little bit more, but before you do, you might want to just talk about the diagnosis and how that might maybe differs from diagnosis of just plain old type of thyroidism or any other thyroid condition.
Right. So usually you'll pick up on it from the symptoms, but usually the TSH, thyroid stimulating hormone, is going to be elevated. And looking at total T4, total T3, free T4, free T3, many times those are going to be decreased. But the two antibodies you want to run to really make the diagnosis are thyroid peroxidase antibodies and anti-thyroglobulin antibodies. And you've got to run both. I see a lot of blood work done from other practitioners, and they just do thyroid peroxidase. But you can have anti-thyroglobulin antibodies positive, and thyroid peroxidase antibodies could be negative, so you really have to run both. And if any of those are elevated, then you know they have it. Now, to diagnose Graves, which is kind of the opposite, you can run what's called a TSI, thyroid-stimulating immunoglobulin, and then also TSH receptor antibodies. And if any of those are positive, then you also have a diagnosis of Graves. You could also see a mixed Hashimoto's and Graves. They'll have, say, thyroid peroxidase is positive, and they'll have the TSI positive, so they actually have both. And Hashimoto's can actually start off as like a Graves presentation because there's a lot of inflammation in the thyroid gland. It's producing a lot of extra hormone, so they actually have symptoms of too much thyroid hormone, but it's actually the beginning stages of Hashimoto's, and then they eventually fall into the hypothyroid category over time as the thyroid gland gets destroyed from the immune system.
That's very interesting, and I did not know that that the thyroid peroxidase can be negative, and so you really all absolutely have to also order the anti-thyroid antibody. That's fascinating.
Exactly.
And then I have seen patients where they seem to be, you know, overproducing, but then they go into like a complete hypothyroid. Of course, they like to use that as a treatment to kind of burn the thyroid out to, and then treat them with thyroid hormone. But mm-hmm. I've never heard before that that's the beginning of the Hashimoto's. That's very interesting.
Yeah, they can certainly present that way.
Mm-hmm. All right. So, you know, you've got this thyroid gland, and you've got, you know, you were mentioning this is really an immune system disorder, and you also mentioned that autoimmune is on the rise, and we're all seeing that, so we absolutely cannot disagree with that. So the thyroid gland, you know, right in the throat, right in the center below, between the head and the rest of the body, why is this gland so prone to autoimmune disease?
Well, there's actually a paper, I want to quote it, was just published this year in 2011 out of the journal Hormone Research. And actually the title of the paper is, Why is the Thyroid So Prone to Autoimmune Disease?
Really?
So it's out there, and everyone, even in conventional medicine and in research, they're trying to figure out why is it so prevalent now and why is it growing. And basically the authors say that these are basically preventable environmental factors like high iodine intake, selenium deficiency, pollutants such as tobacco smoke and industrial smog, as well as infectious diseases and certain drugs, they've all been implicated in the development of autoimmune thyroiditis.
Mm-hmm.
So you really have to have three things for autoimmune disease. Number one is a genetic predisposition. There's not a lot we can do about that, at least not yet. The second thing is usually gut permeability, leaky gut. And with our modern-day high-stress lifestyles, electromagnetic radiation, you know, computers, cell phones. We're all under more stress. We're working longer hours. There's more pollution. As you know, Linda, our food is hollow. You can pick up an orange off the shelf, and it might not even have a single milligram of vitamin C in it.
Yeah.
Medications, infections, toxic metals. So they're recognizing this in conventional literature that it is the environment and our modern-day lifestyles that are triggering this. Now, the thyroid is just, it's very sensitive to toxins, and it's the largest endocrine gland in the body. It gets a very, very high blood supply, you know, right there directly from the heart. And over time, if there's enough environmental insults, then the autoimmunity can be triggered.
Fascinating. So it reminds me of the Dr. Lord did a lecture at our Glacier Fest this summer in August, and he talked about the perfect storm, but he was referring to autism. But I think, you know, a lot of us came out of that lecture saying, wow, the perfect storm is, you know, can relate to fibromyalgia, can relate to Hashimoto's, can relate to so many other, probably most of the disorders that functional medicine practitioners like yourself deal with. It's never just one cause, not typically. And I think that throws off our medical doctors as to why they can't just put everything under a tiny little simple blanket.
Exactly. And, you know, the thyroid, they do also mention in the paper that the thyroid hormone production is a very complex hormonal synthesis pathway, and it has these real peculiar requirements that are different from a lot of other endocrine-producing glands. So those are other factors that can come into play in autoimmunity.
Yeah, and also those receptors that have to be working properly that stimulate the production. You talk about that a little bit. I don't know if you want to go into that a little more.
Well, yeah, I mean, just the basics of thyroid hormone production. You have iodine entering the thyroid gland. You have L-tyrosine. And then there's a whole host of vitamins and minerals that you need to make it. Vitamin A, magnesium, copper, zinc, B vitamins. I mean, there's a lot that goes into manufacturing thyroid hormone itself. It's a very complex process.
And so even those nutrients need to be there, and then those receptors need to be turned on and working properly, and maybe not even damaged by the chemicals that you mentioned earlier.
Exactly, and, you know, thyroid-disrupting chemicals, also known as TDCs, can give the illusion that the thyroid is working normally because they can disrupt the actual nuclear receptors in the cell. So, you know, TSH can look good and all the free T4, free T3 can look good, but these chemicals in our environment can really throw things off.
Do you mind, this is a good time to maybe go into the chemicals in more detail? I know you want to talk about toxic metals maybe a little later, but do you want to go into that right now?
I can go into that a little bit later, tie it in with the toxic metals.
Okay, very good. I'd love for you to give us more information about something I know that you like to spend a lot of time on, like you did in the book, and I think that you feel that a lot of people that go to a traditional medical doctor are not hearing about this and what you call the infection connection.
Right. Basically, it started with, it was a combination of things. It was a paper I read back in 2006 looking at molecular mimicry and Borrelia burgdorferi, the bacteria that causes Lyme disease, and its connection with autoimmune thyroiditis. And the authors found that the surface proteins on Borrelia burgdorferi can mimic thyroid tissue. So a Borrelia burgdorferi infection can trigger autoimmune thyroid disease. And I started seeing more and more Lyme disease patients and more Hashimoto's patients. And testing the Hashimoto's patients for Lyme and looking at their history, many times you would uncover they actually did have Lyme. And vice versa, you know, you start testing your Lyme disease patients for Hashimoto's, and many of them are coming back with positive antibodies. And that's just one of the things, one of the major three criteria for autoimmunity is some kind of environmental trigger, and many times it's an infection.
Mm-hmm.
And for years, you know, people have been talking about gluten and vitamin D, and that's definitely a major, major player in some cases of autoimmune thyroiditis, but not in all of them. And I found that And there's actually quite a lot of literature on this. In fact, there's a paper in the journal Virology in 2009, and the whole paper is a review of all the viruses that can trigger autoimmune thyroiditis. And you look at it, and you see Epstein-Barr virus, you see the influenza virus, hepatitis C, parvovirus, B19, human foamy virus, the herpes virus. I mean, all these viruses can trigger autoimmune thyroiditis. It can cause Hashimoto's. It can cause Graves. It can cause subacute thyroiditis. So I start seeing the Lyme disease and its co-infections causing it. And then you start tracking down the viruses. You're seeing those are causing it. And then you're seeing infections in the gut, like Dr. Brady has talked about before, the Yersinia enterocolitica, which is found in the gut. And that also has molecular mimicry type presentations where the body recognizes the surface proteins of the Yersinia eggs, and it looks just like thyroid tissue. So you'll find Yersinia on the stool analysis in some of your patients with Hashimoto's, and when you eradicate it, you can get really good results. Some of the other...
When you say looks like... I'm sorry, when you say, didn't mean to interrupt, but when you say looks like the thyroid tissue, is that what you and some others refer to as molecular mimicry?
Exactly. So the body's immune system, you know, your immune system is basically monitoring amino acid sequences at the cellular level, and if it sees something that looks exactly like something else, it doesn't really know the difference. It just knows that it's going to tag it, and it's going to attack it. And so if these surface proteins look the same as self tissue, then the immune system will attack both.
Okay, so keep going. So that's very interesting. You mentioned all these different viruses that we're all very familiar with that all have such an effect on the immune system. I think what you're saying is that they can be one of the key players in the causation of thyroid autoimmune disease, not just being deficient in vitamin D, not just having a sensitivity to gluten. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying. Because you can go gluten-free and heal the gut and get their vitamin D levels optimal, and you can see there's still something that's really driving the infection. And when you start analyzing your blood chemistries, you know, you're going to see their CBC differential is going to be out of whack, low white blood cell count or high. You'll see the pattern of high monocytes and eosinophils, usually indicating parasite or yeast infection in the gut. And then you'll see elevated lymphocytes and low neutrophils that usually indicates chronic viral activity, but you'll also see that with Lyme disease. So you can pick some of these up just on your basic blood chemistries. But even going further than the Lyme disease and the viruses and the gut infections, there are a lot of co-infections out there that the ticks also carry. And there's some really good research out of South Africa on rickettsia species and autoimmune thyroiditis. And rickettsia is a common co-infection in Lyme disease. And it wreaks havoc on the adrenals, thyroid, the heart, you name it. And a lot of these patients will come in presenting with like fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue syndrome, autoimmune disease. They're just completely wiped out. And then you test them and you find out they have rickettsia as well as other co-infections like Babesia, Ehrlichia, and Babesiosis. It's the most common co-infection in Lyme disease. But where I am in North Carolina, we see a lot of rickettsia that the ticks also carry. And some people will have rickettsia, but they don't have Lyme disease. And the rickettsia is bad enough because, you know, it's almost impossible to get rid of, like Lyme, once it gets deep into the system. So you really have to identify these infections and go after them and shut them down if you really want to shut down the autoimmunity.
Is it, you're saying rickettsia is really difficult to get rid of. Dr. Hedberg, is it difficult to spot it when it's deep in the system, or is it easier to find out that someone has it when it's an early infection versus it's been there a long time?
Yeah, I mean, most people are going to know when they have it. They're going to get Rocky Mountain spotted fever, and people know that right away because the symptoms can be, I mean, sometimes it can kill you. I mean, that's how bad it can be.
Wow.
But they're going to know if they've had it in the beginning. They'll be really, really sick, really, really ill. They might have been taken to the emergency room, and they're told that, you know, they just had a really bad bug. But usually they're going to know, they're going to have symptoms, and no one's really figuring out what it is. And then I like to do PCR testing for rickettsia. That seems to be the best to identify it.
Okay.
And it'll show up in many cases of these Hashimoto's patients.
I live in the woods, and I have two dogs, and I know that my dogs have babesia, and so they're susceptible to some of these same things like the Lyme, different organisms. I always thought there was just one or two. There's a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah,
there's new ones all the time, you know, new species of Borrelia burgdorferi, and there's some new protozoa out there, the FL1953, that's just been identified when MS and Lou Gehrig's disease. So there's all kinds of new bugs showing up.
Well, I don't know. It just makes you either want to live in a bubble, stay inside, or I don't know. Fortunately, I love being outside. All right. Well, it's a good thing there's great doctors like you and out there, and all of you that are listening on the line right now. So thank God for that. Okay, so all these different infections, you did a really good job with the viruses and these different organisms that people and animals can get infected with. So anything else you want to add to the whole infection connection?
You know, some people ask, well, what came first? You know, is it the gut that broke down and the immune system was weak? Is it emotional? Is it the toxins? Because not everyone that gets infected actually manifests the infection. You know, some people, their bodies are able to fight it off.
Right.
And it's a combination of things. You know, Linda, Lyme disease is on the rise. It's the most common infection in the country. Vector-borne infection. It's on the rise. It's spreading everywhere, but we also have a large population of people with very, very weak immune systems from under all kinds of stress, like we talked about in the beginning. So I don't know if you can pinpoint it on one thing, which came first. I think it's a combination of how we live our lives now and what's going on in our environment.
Yep, absolutely. Well, of course, the environment's getting worse and worse every year, too. Right, Dr. Hedberg?
That's exactly right.
Yeah. So I guess when you add all this up, it's not all that surprising that autoimmune diseases are probably the kind of hot thing that's on the rise right now. And like you said, certainly Lyme disease, and that's unfortunate. But as long as there's more and more mercury that we're all being exposed to and the other 100 million chemicals, and all of these, I guess we're going to be dealing with a lot of Hashimoto's. So I think what you're also trying to say is that they could be exposed to these organisms and not they might get Lyme, they might not necessarily get Hashimoto's, but it sounds to me like you really noticed a really strong correlation between the number of patients that had Lyme and Hashimoto's concurrently.
Exactly, yeah.
A lot of people. Yeah, that's really...
Yeah, I mean, either Lyme or the chronic viral activity or these many common gut infections that you see.
Well, I know that there's other things with the gut that relate to thyroiditis. You already did talk about the organisms, but then there's also, and you mentioned earlier that so many people are bringing up gluten and vitamin D, but isn't there more to that?
Right. You know, you definitely want to go gluten-free with these patients and get their vitamin D levels at a good level. But, inflammation is bidirectional, you know, in the gut. You could have leaky gut causing inflammation in the system, but you could also have inflammation due to infections or toxins outside of the gut causing inflammation in the intestine. So it's not a matter of just patching up the gut. that's part of it, but you also have to identify anything outside of that area of the body. Many of these patients, you'll want to do your 4R protocol, you know, digestive enzymes, antimicrobials, probiotics, and GI repair. And many people with gluten intolerance, they also have other food allergies, because as you know, the more permeable the gut becomes, the more food sensitivities are going to develop.
Sure.
And really, you know, the big five, you have gluten, corn, soy, dairy, and eggs. Those seem to be really the most common ones that I see. Mm-hmm. And so you've got to get them off of the foods that they're eating and patch up their gut. I like to use the GI effects test with Metametrics.
Right.
That one seems to be the best that I've found for actually picking up some of these really stealth bugs that are in the gut.
Sorry, I was actually swallowing a vitamin. Yeah, absolutely. The GI effects is very effective. And then before we leave the gluten thing, I also want you to talk about the candida, which is extremely common, and I know you talk about that in your book too.
Right. Candida, it's very, very common in our society. People who have, you know, high sugar diets, high processed carbohydrates, and, you know, it could also be a protective infection, some doctors have said, because it does absorb toxins. And when you go after it, those toxins are released into the system, and the patient has Herxheimer, and sometimes they get sicker. I used to be a little bit more aggressive in going after candida, but then I kind of backed off, and now I'm just using more of an approach where I'm really building up the immune system in the gut with Saccharomyces, boulardii, and everything else in the 4R protocol. And it almost seems to work better when you just crowd it out, so to speak, instead of just going directly at it and eradicating it. Because some of the antimicrobials out there, people have bad reactions to them, and putting them on some of these herbs that can be very irritating, like wormwood as an example. Mm-hmm. If you already have an inflamed, leaky gut, and then you start throwing some harsh herbs there to eradicate yeast, sometimes that's just not the best approach. I found just being a little bit gentler with that seems to work better.
I agree with you, and a lot of you might not know that our Floramyces product is the Saccharomyces boulardii, so we haven't done a good job of letting you know that we have that product. So that makes a lot of sense, that if you go in and kind of take the bad foods out, like the gluten or another food allergies, heal the gut, build up the probiotics, I guess you want to call them. And then, of course, you're fixing the immune system as you do all of these things, that you don't have to be so aggressive with trying to kill off every little thing, because they shouldn't really be thriving there in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's usually there because of a weakened immune system.
Right.
So if you just wipe it out and their secretory IgA is still low and their immune system's weak, then it's just going to grow back, or they're going to get infected with something else.
Absolutely. And what about toxic metals? And you also sometimes hear about a connection between toxic metals and organisms like candida, and I know you talk about that a little bit.
Right. So really the major players with toxic metals in the thyroid are mercury, cadmium, and arsenic, not so much lead, aluminum, and nickel. These can get into the gland, especially mercury, and disrupt enzymes that are involved in thyroid hormone production. But then the patient can also have an immune reaction to specific metals, which can actually trigger the autoimmunity. It's a really interesting paper out of the Czech Republic where they looked at dental amalgams, mercury-containing amalgams in patients with Hashimoto's. Mm-hmm. And if the patient actually had an immune sensitivity to mercury and they took the amalgams out, then their antibody levels dropped. But if the patient did not have an immune reaction to mercury, then it didn't change the antibody levels at all. So you don't necessarily want to go and just have everyone, you know, take their amalgams out if they have Hashimoto's, because it may or may not be an issue. I don't see, you know, arsenic and cadmium as much as a disruptor as mercury. But again, with our leaky modern day leaky guts and dental amalgams and more coal plants, we're getting a greater exposure to mercury. And it's a potent endocrine disruptor. There was a really good paper that I quoted in my book about mercury and its effect on the endocrine system. And it's almost scary when you read it because, you know, it's going to affect not only the glands themselves, but it's also going to affect the pituitary. And so it can disrupt it from the pituitary level, the glandular level, the actual hormone production, conversion enzymes like the 5' deiodinase, which activates T4 into T3.
Sure.
And then it can also disrupt at the cellular level. So you have T3 going into the cell, binding to nuclear receptors, and mercury can be there, you know, in the same place. So it can really hit you from many, many different angles. So it's not just disrupting hormone production, but from an immune perspective, it can also trigger autoimmune disease. So you have to look at it in both ways. One is more with the immune system, and then one is more mechanical, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that makes sense. And I'm sure that adds to oxidative stress that these people probably already have issues with, especially if they have these viruses and other organisms that they're infected with, whether they know it or not.
Right. Basically, what the literature is showing with oxidative stress and autoimmune thyroiditis, autoimmune disease in general, is that, you know, a lot of these patients with autoimmune diseases, they're going to be very, very low in their antioxidant status.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of these papers look at coenzyme Q10, vitamin E, and selenium.
Yep.
And what they found is that patients with autoimmune thyroiditis, their selenium levels are very low.
Mm-hmm.
And supplementing, and this is just in your conventional peer-reviewed literature, they actually state that using selenium is a viable treatment option for autoimmune thyroid disease, you know, along with thyroid hormone. So it's recognized, but, you know, conventional physicians aren't really using it. The studies show that just using selenium alone is going to bring their antibody levels down. And that can be for a few reasons. Number one, selenium is a potent antioxidant. Number two, you need it for thyroid hormone production. And number three, it binds to mercury.
Yep.
And so if mercury is causing oxidative stress in the gland, you can hit it from a lot of different angles just with selenium.
Yeah, absolutely. Our iodine synergy product, we named it that because we added selenium to it, which I don't see many iodine products out there that have the selenium in it. Thank you for mentioning all the important things that it does.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned earlier how important how much the thyroid depends on having iodine around, too, to be able to make the hormones.
Yeah, and the other antioxidant I wanted to mention was N-acetylcysteine.
Mm-hmm.
I've actually been using a lot more of that than I ever have.
Yeah.
Because the more, you know, papers you read on oxidative stress and autoimmune disease, the more NAC pops up.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's really great increasing glutathione levels. It's really good for the barrier system, like the gut barrier and the lungs and the sinuses. Increases glutathione levels in the brain. And there was one particular study on NAC and autoimmune thyroiditis, and it just really, really brings down the oxidative stress in the gland. So I think it's a great supplement. There aren't that many, you know, magic pills out there, but you can see some pretty rapid results when you use NAC with people.
Yeah, when you mentioned oxidative stress, and immediately I was thinking raising glutathione levels first, and that came to my mind. And I mean, I personally use our glutathione powder, and even if it's just working in the gut, or you know, I hold it in my throat a long time, maybe it's able to get to the thyroid gland, but it makes me feel better very, very quickly. So, and NAC is a great idea for whatever it takes to get the glutathione levels increased as quickly as possible. I'm not surprised that. Not surprised that the research is strong on that. And then also, if you look up, we mentioned lung and all that. If you look, I did a lecture on COPD and lung disorders, and the main nutrient that kept coming up in all the literature was NAC, NAC, NAC. So.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. All right. So I think that, you know, we did a little bit on Graves' disease earlier. I think you it might be interesting to hear you talk about you know, the causes behind that. Are they any much different, and how different of a disorder is that from what we just discussed earlier?
Right. So with Graves' disease, you know, it can still have all the same causes that we talked about, but there are a few that tend to be very specific for Graves.
Okay.
And Graves, you really have to be careful with. You know, I'm not an endocrinologist, and you have to be very careful with Graves because the patient could have a thyroid storm and end up in the emergency room. So what I found is that if these Graves' disease patients, if you catch them relatively early, you can work wonders with them. And there's a few things that are really important to know about that. Number one was a paper published in 2010, and they found a correlation between H. pylori infection and Graves' disease. So basically what they're saying in the paper is that, yes, we know that viral and bacterial antigens can mimic the antigenic profile of thyroid cell membranes, and that can trigger autoimmune disease. But they wanted to look specifically at H. pylori because in developed countries, about 50% of the population has it. So they did stool tests on patients with Graves' disease, and they found that there's definitely an association between H. pylori and Graves' disease. It was actually a significant, I mean, that's the words that they use, a significant increased rate of prevalence is present in Graves' disease. So what I did is, you know, you don't run stool tests on everyone, but start running more of them on Graves' disease patients. And the vast majority of them are coming back with active H. pylori infections. This is what I was talking about before, the infection connection.
Yep.
And H. pylori, the protocol for that has worked pretty straightforward. The product that you have under the GastroMend HP,
yep,
that's designed for H. pylori.
Right.
I mean, that's worked really well for me. You want to do probiotics and your 4-hour protocol, but throw in the GastroMend HP and retest the stool 2 or 3 months later, and it's going to be gone. And you're going to find that their symptoms have gotten a lot better when you get rid of the H. pylori because it's just sitting there. And again, like we talked about before, it's driving the autoimmunity. So you've got to look for H. pylori and Graves' disease patients. The other thing is you can use, there's two herbs that work really well for Graves, bugleweed and lemon balm, and these work by regulating thyroid-stimulating immunoglobulin, the TSI test, which I talked about before. And if you use both of those, you can really see improvements in their symptoms relatively quickly.
What was the other one?
You know,
lemon balm?
Bugleweed.
How do you spell it?
Like a bugle, B-U-G-L-E-W-E-E-D.
Okay. Have you ever seen anything on, what is it called, fenugreek? Is it fenugreek that's also good for that? No?
Yeah, I haven't used it, but I have read some things in the past about that.
Yeah, I've read some things too. And you also like carnitine for Graves' disease, you say in your book.
Right. Carnitine it's basically a peripheral antagonist to thyroid hormone action. If there's too much, it does inhibit both T3 and T4 entry into the cell nuclei, and that's important because if they do have Graves, if they're hyperthyroid, it's going to really help them. This particular study, I think this was the New York Academy of Sciences, this particular trial, they looked at 2 grams versus 4 grams of oral carnitine, and they found that overall the two doses of carnitine, 2 and 4 grams, were equally effective in reversing hyperthyroid symptomatology, and it worked relatively quickly. So the symptoms were ameliorated in about 1 to 2 weeks after commencement of the carnitine.
Mm-hmm.
So I like the ClinoClear because you get a nice high dose, you know, 1,500 milligrams per teaspoon.
Yep.
And I like to go right in the middle. They looked at 2 and they looked at 4 grams, so I hit them with 3 grams,
yep.
1,500 milligrams twice a day.
That makes sense.
And that works really, really well in their symptoms, and you've got some research here to back that up. Because
great.
Sometimes it can be, it's not the most cost-effective supplement, and that's why that liquid works really well for high doses for these people.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know they're probably, like, overstimulated, but I also doubt that all of them are, like, skinny mini. So if they are a little overweight, certainly they're not too unhappy when you tell them they're going to burn more fat if they take that 3 grams of carnitine a day, right?
Exactly. And, yeah, and some of them, you know, not everyone can tolerate that much. It can cause some loose stools. So you might have to go a little bit lower than 3 grams.
Yep, or spread it out in
mm-hmm.
two doses or a little bit more. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Right.
Very good. All right, so you talk about the 4R for that, the carnitine, the 2 herbs that you mentioned, the lemon balm and the bugleweed, healing, dealing with H. pylori with stuff like Gastromend. That's fantastic. Anything else you want to talk about?
The other thing is goitrogens.
Oh, yeah.
I know you know a lot about that as a nutritionist, Linda, and goitrogens basically will inhibit thyroid function. So they can be actually utilized in a Graves patients when they're hyperthyroid. You don't have to worry about that. You actually want that. So if you look in your brassica vegetable group, you know, like cauliflower, cabbage,
broccoli,
Brussels sprouts, broccoli, all that, usually you want to at least steam those to neutralize some of the goitrogenic activity. But in this case, you can have them eat them raw. And then other goitrogens are like soybeans. Usually I don't recommend soy unless it's fermented, but
mm-hmm.
soybeans have goitrogenic activity. Pine nuts, peanuts, millet, strawberries, pears, peaches, spinach, radishes. Not everyone wants to eat those raw. And I don't think I get anyone to eat raw radishes, but some of the other ones, you know, like spinach and millet and those other things I mentioned, if they increase their intake of those, it will help bring down the hyperthyroid symptoms.
Okay. So thank you, because out of the diet piece, and I know you still want to talk about the diet piece with hyperthyroid. Before we do you anything else you want to talk about back with thyroiditis, like supplements, nutrition guidelines?
Let's talk a little bit about iodine. It's been a very controversial topic.
I agree.
You know, over the last 5 or 6 years, and
mm-hmm.
I'll just give my humble perspective on the whole thing. Basically, what we're looking at is a misinterpretation of a paper that was published in Japan on the dietary intake of iodine for Japanese mainlanders,
mm-hmm.
and it was actually misquoted. You know, a particular physician said that they're taking in about 12 to 13 milligrams of iodine a day, and that just simply is not true. If you look at the paper that was published in the journal Thyroid in 2008
mm-hmm.
by Nagataki, and if you really want to read some really good information about iodine and the thyroid, Nagataki has done a lot of the research on that. And according to Nagataki, the average dietary iodine intake of Japanese mainlanders is 1.2 milligrams per day.
Mm-hmm.
I also recommend Dr. Jeff Moss's iodine series. He wrote many newsletters on this, really getting deep into the science and the literature behind this. There's some really, really good papers out there out of Johns Hopkins, published in the Journal of Autoimmunity, and they state that the best established environmental factor in autoimmune thyroiditis is excess dietary iodine. And another paper out of Autoimmune Review in 2002, this was a review, and they found that a body of clinical and epidemiologic evidence points to excessive ingestion of iodine as an environmental agent in Hashimoto's. And there's a few things that are really important to understand about this. If someone already has Hashimoto's and you give them iodine, what the literature shows is that you will increase lymphocytic infiltration into the thyroid gland. So you're going to increase oxidative stress, you're going to increase inflammation, and you're really going to disrupt thyroid hormone production if you do that. That's just what the literature shows.
Yep.
If they're non-autoimmune and they are truly iodine deficient, then iodine can work wonders for certain people. But this idea that it's this panacea for all thyroid disorders, that's just simply not supported by the evidence. So I don't use iodine if they have autoimmunity. If they don't have autoimmunity, then that's going to depend on the patient. And do they have fibrocystic breast disease? Do they have signs of hypothyroidism? Do they have issues with estrogen metabolism?
They do quite well on iodine, the people that you're mentioning right now.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
And that's another good point, Linda, is that there's a lot of literature out there that says it's not everyone can just take it, even if you don't have autoimmunity. There's some good papers out there that giving iodine to individuals is not necessarily going to not cause any problems. Some people will have problems with iodine, but I agree with you. You know, there's a lot of people that can take iodine safely and effectively. But again, do they actually need it? That's really the question you want to find out.
Well, I think, you know, interesting point to all of this, Dr. Hedberg, is that, you know, we're looking at the Japanese intake, and you're saying 1.2. Obviously, somebody decided to move that decimal point over to the right and came up with 12 milligrams.
Right.
But we're also talking about practitioners that have been trained on 12, 25, 50, 100. I mean, really going beyond 12.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I would think it would be different for me to give a patient 10 milligrams for 2 months. And I think it would be a lot different to give that same person 50 milligrams for 6 months.
Right.
So I think that's where a lot of people are confused, is how much is a normal and how much is a lot, because we originally talked about micrograms, MCGs, which is about a thousandth of a milligram. And when you go from an MCG to an MG, it's a horse of a different color.
Right. And again, there are cases where you can go that high, and sometimes it can help, but you have to be very careful. Example, you know, I have worked with a few Lyme disease patients who, you know, did very, very well on high doses of iodine because it does work as an antimicrobial. I was almost using it more as, you know, the whole infection connection thing that I've been talking about. Iodine is a potent antimicrobial.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when I got a cut when I was a kid, that was the first thing that, you know, my mom or my grandma grabbed was iodine to put on it because it just kills everything.
Yes, exactly. And I think in the emergency room, it's sometimes still used to throw over the wounds to have them not get infected when they're about to open people up. So I think we all remember those days. And, of course, the mercurochrome was the wand that spit out the red stuff or the orange stuff, right? And iodine was the purple stuff. Is that right?
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Basically, you know, that's just my experience and what I've read in the literature, and some practitioners report having great results with it, but all I'm saying is use a lot of caution if the patient has autoimmune disease of the thyroid.
Yep, I think I'd like to go back to your old idea, which is NAC and whatever it takes to raise glutathione, to do that before you go in with things like iodine, because you're, like you said, that might be affecting the immune system, where you want to first have adequate selenium, to protect against mercury, and then you want glutathione to get rid of the oxidative stress before you go in with like iodine. So that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And I would love for you to tell our whole audience how they can get your book, Dr. Hedberg.
The best place to get it is on Amazon.com. Just type in, you know, my name or the Thyroid Alternative. And I see Amazon's already discounted it.
Really?
So you can get it for less than the actual cover price now. But well,
sorry. You'll sell lots of them. So, and the spelling, everybody, is N-I-K-O-L-A-S, and last name H-E-D-B-E-R-G, and the title, The Thyroid Alternative, Renew Your Thyroid Naturally.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Very good. Thank you. Are you ready for questions or any last words?
Yeah, I'm ready for questions.
Oh, hi. Quite an interesting talk. About 8 months ago, I got hyperthyroid, and I did a lot of research on this, and I just wanted to reiterate some of the things that you mentioned, and that would be I had my TSI was fine, my peroxidase antibodies was fine, but my antithyroid globulin was off the charts.
Wow.
That can, you know, that's one of the things I wanted to just say.
Yeah, great.
The other thing is that I took bugleweed motherwort lemon balm, and I was juicing cabbage as a goitrogen. That's a pain to juice that cabbage, but it worked quite well because you're getting a lot of goitrogens in your body. So to make a long story short, now it took about 6 months, and now the thyroid is normalized. My TSH is fine, but still have antithyroid globulin antibodies.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the immune system is doing something. I'm working on the gut, but. And then the other thing I wanted to mention was I came up with the same conclusion about iodine. I looked at the Japanese studies, and what I found was even in that author that you mentioned, if you looked at it, there was a considerable and there was two cities in Japan where they did a comparison, and one had a little bit less iodine intake than the other city, and. But when you really looked at the literature, you saw there was a considerable number of people who had thyroid autoimmune disease. I mean, a higher percentage than you would have in the United States. Anyway, that's the way I interpreted it. And I was taking extra iodine before this happened. I think maybe a year and a half, 2 years, I was sprinkling seaweed on my salads. And I realized after looking into it that gave me about, beside what would come in a multivitamin, about a gram a day.
Mm-hmm.
So if that was a predisposing factor, I'm not sure. But basically that's what I wanted to mention. And now I'm normalized, but, you know, and this could be Hashimoto's because I never had TSI. You don't know if it was a spilling of the hormones, but I don't have any Hashimoto-type symptoms, but. Anyway, for whatever that was worth.
Well, thanks for sharing all that. Really appreciate it.
But what Hashimoto's symptoms would people really notice?
Well, just your basic hypothyroid symptoms, fatigue, weight gain, depression, mm-hmm. constipation, cold hands and feet, things like that.
Yeah. All right, next question. Thank you very much for sharing all of that with us. And personal experiences are very helpful.
Good evening, Dr. Solano here from Wisconsin. Could you please repeat again what journal you found that article, Why Thyroid is So Prone to Autoimmune Disease? What's the name of the journal again?
The Journal of Autoimmunity, November, December. Yeah, Journal of Autoimmunity. And also Autoimmune Review. Those are just two of them. You know, if you do a Medline search for iodine and thyroiditis, you're going to get tons of papers on that.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, yes. Can you just talk about the diet for hypothyroid?
All right. It's good. It's kind of a long a long topic, but basically you're just asking what is the diet for someone with Hashimoto's?
Yeah, I thought it was going to be discussed in the lecture, and then you started talking about iodine, so I'm just not sure where you're going to go with it.
So basically, you know, the diet for someone with Hashimoto's is not going to be that much different from anybody else. You know, you want to do all the things that you would normally do, with just a few things in mind. Number one, I do like to have them establish an alkaline pH, eating more alkaline-forming foods, getting the pH above 6.4. That would be the first thing. And then the second thing would be a diet that is basically one that's going to focus on healing the gut. So you want to have them rotate their foods, eliminating gluten, of course, and other food allergies that you might suspect. The nutritionist that works for me, she goes over different broths for people. Bone broths are really good for healing the gut, vegetable broths, things like that. And those are, you know, really the basics for someone with Hashimoto's.
Thank you.
Hi. I have a couple of questions. One is, do you feel comfortable using the Nature Throid or the porcine-based T3, T4 in people with autoimmune? There's been some controversy about that.
Yeah, those are definitely necessary in some cases, and they work really well. For someone who actually needs thyroid hormone replacement, they seem to work better than the more synthetic, you know, just straight level thyroxin.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Nature Throid and Armor, since they have T3 in them, some people just tend to do better on those. And like you said, they're from a natural source. So I have no, you know, opposition against any of those. I think they work great. And, like I said, some people really do need to be on those.
Okay. And if someone's hypothyroid, would you tell them not to use carnitine? Or is it still a benefit for fatigue and fat loss, you know, fat burning with these people that have weight issues and are often tired? Is it going to be counterproductive, or is it still okay to use?
Yeah, Linda and I talked about this earlier, and based on, you know, my research on what I've read and my clinical experience, giving carnitine to someone with a normal thyroid function or low thyroid function, it's not going to decrease thyroid function. It's more of a thyroid adaptogen, so to speak, where it's only going to decrease thyroid hormone entry into the cell if there's too much in the system.
Okay.
I agree with that from what I've read. I agree.
Yeah, I've had that issue come up where, you know, I think it's helpful, but then they get on the Internet and they're all freaked out and I'm like,
yeah.
Not exactly sure what to say, and then, you know.
You know where I think that's coming from, if you don't mind me adding in? I think that comes from people, just like the, similar to the iodine story, kind of extrapolating that if, in this study, carnitine had a suppressive effect on decreasing the production of, let's say, T4, that means you should assume that it would decrease production of T4 with everyone, and that's a huge assumption, and it doesn't even really make sense. Like I was saying to Dr. Hedberg, if I use 4 grams of taurine on someone with hypertension, their blood pressure might hopefully decrease, but I take taurine and I'm hypotensive and mine does not decrease. You know, the body's very regulatory when it comes to using nutrients, very different from drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Right, okay.
Exactly.
I just wanted to clarify that. Thank you. The last question has to do with people that are not so much Hashimoto's, but in general with hypothyroid, I find that I have a number of patients that have a low or lowish TSH, but they're thyroid hormone levels, their T3 and T4 free, are quite low. You know, so then I'm a little stumped as to how to best treat them. You know, I've heard treat the levels of the hormone, but then you get into issues with really suppressing the TSH. So I was just curious what you find that means and what you do if you see that.
So if you see somewhat normal thyroid hormones and the TSH is low, there's a few things that I found that can cause that. Number one is they usually have had some kind of extremely stressful event in their life, or they're under high amounts of stress, because cortisol will inhibit the anterior pituitary and will lower TSH. So that's one thing to look at. The other thing is chronic inflammation will cause the TSH to go down. So those are the two things that I see the most, is stress-related physiology and chronic inflammation.
And if the T3 and T4 are low and the TSH is low, do you feel like it would be still helpful to give a little support, whether it be glandular or natrithroid or whatever, to the thyroid, even if the TSH is on the normal or low side?
You know, it's just each case is so individual.
Right.
It's hard to say with each person. You could certainly see mixed presentations where their TSH is very low because of anterior pituitary suppression, and then their actual hormones are very low because they're iodine deficient, or they have mercury toxicity, or, you know, I'm just seeing more and more of these mixed presentations, and they could show up with almost anything. But if you feel like, you know, you have to look at it from a few different ways. You have to say, what do I want to do to really get these people feeling better as quickly as I can?
Mm-hmm.
And if you feel like they need thyroid hormone so that they can start detoxing better and feeling better and all those kinds of things, then by all means, go ahead and use it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you've seen this before too, obviously. So, okay.
Right.
Well, that's very helpful. Thanks.
All right. Thanks.
Oh, yes, Doctor. Thank you for this talk. My question is about NAC. What dosage are you finding to be useful? And have you come to any conclusion that NAC should be with food or without food on an empty stomach? I've heard both.
NAC can be dosed with food at 1,000 milligrams twice a day. I give it 1,000 with breakfast and 1,000 with dinner. And you really don't need much more than that. Yeah, I give it with food at that dose.
You know what it is? Probably, Dr. Hedberg, they're getting hung up on the fact that, you know, L-cysteine's amino acid. And they tend to do that about with carnitine, too. But you correctly said in your book that carnitine's a dipeptide. It's actually not. Doesn't have an amino group and an acid group. Now, L-cysteine does, and acetylcysteine is, like, slightly different in structure, but I just think people get way too worried about how quickly it's going to get absorbed. It's going to get into your system whether you eat it with chicken, steak, or coffee, you know, or water. It's going to get there.
Right.
Whether it's 10 minutes later, who cares? Whatever is easiest probably for the patient, you know, unless it has it's something that has to be taken with food, like EGCG green tea you give with food, not because of it's fat soluble, just because it'll upset your stomach if you don't, you know.
Things like that.
I think you should do what's easiest unless there's a really big reason to take it empty or full stomach. That's my opinion.
Right.
All right. Thank you. Very helpful.
Hi, Doctor. I have a question about Yersinia enterocolitica you mentioned in the comprehensive stool analysis. Hello?
Yes.
We're here.
Yes. Will the eradication prevent the autoimmune disease if you treat it right away? Like, I had this patient recently with the stool analysis. It was 4+. She is teenager, and she has no symptoms at all, and CBC was normal. And the only thing the susceptible, it was to Cipro and tetracycline, which is not good for teenagers at all. So the first question, would you suggest an antibiotic treatment or any other treatment? And would this treatment prevent the autoimmune disease?
Right. I'd like to use the herbal compounds that are recommended on the sensitivity to eradicate the Yersinia. And second part of the question is, if in fact the Yersinia triggered the autoimmunity, see, once the gene has turned on the X chromosome, it can't be turned off. So So we can't really say that if you get rid of the Yersinia that the autoimmune disease is cured. But if you do eradicate the Yersinia, most of the time you will see the antibody levels come way down or to the level where they're not detectable. But that doesn't mean that the autoimmune disease is gone.
I see. And what herbal treatment do you usually use in your practice for that?
It really depends on what comes back on the sensitivity, but the garlic works really well, oil of oregano, caprylic acid, thyme, cat's claw, there's a whole list of them. Berberine works really well, any
Absolutely.
Of those.
Probiotic
yeah.
as well, of course. Yes.
Yeah, and a probiotic, black
mm-hmm.
walnut, I believe they're testing now as well,
mm-hmm.
but all of those will work well.
I see.
I'm glad you asked that because I had planned on mentioning the new silver psyllium product that I was really excited about when I was going to talk about the whole infection connection thing because I've been using colloidal silver for years and but the silver psyllium that Design for Health is coming out with I'm excited about because I'm going to start using it for all these stealth infections I talk about because it works really, really well for viruses and rickettsia and Lyme, and yeast, and fungi, and just a whole host of things.
Mm-hmm. I see. Thank you so much. And one more question on L-carnitine. The question is, for how long you can use it, and if you discontinue it abruptly, would it cause any symptoms, or you have to taper it?
Yeah, that's a really good question. After you feel like you have the patient stabilized and everything looks good on their lab work and they're feeling good, then you can start to wean them off of the carnitine. The nice thing about the liquid carniclear is that you can titrate it. So if you had them on 3,000 milligrams, then you can go down to 2,500, 2,000, 1,500 and just slowly back them down. If you back them all the way down and they're completely off of it and they're maintaining, then they probably don't need it anymore. But if you start to titrate them down and the symptoms start to come back, then you just have to keep them on it.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Hello. My question is about the labs. What have you found are the best labs for looking for those co-infections and the Lyme, like when you're seeing that you've already treated the GI, you've had someone on a cleanse, and yet they're CD still all over the map, and you're figuring there's probably an infection that's not going to be picked up by, like, GIFX tests or anything? Or are you using, like, the, I'm forgetting what it's called, the Western blot?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really good question. Basically, all the lab testing for Lyme sucks. I mean, I'll just say it flat out, and the couple infections. I mean, the Western blot that you can do through, you know, LabCorp Quest is not going to be that sensitive. The ELISA test is really not that sensitive. And then you have all your specialty labs like Igenix
right.
and Spirostat and Fry Labs. And there's a bunch of them. I've used all of them with varying results. Sometimes you know a patient has the infection and you do the testing through a specialty lab and nothing comes back, but you know they have it. So one of the things that I do is I run a CD57 test through LabCorp, which tends to be suppressed by Borrelia burgdorferi. So if you see that low, then you can get a good idea that they do have some kind of chronic infection. And then from their just regular blood work, you can tell that. But, I mean, I'll be honest with you, sometimes it's just not going to show up anywhere. I mean, some of these bugs are so stealth that no matter what kind of testing you do, it's just not going to show up.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Stealth beaters, huh?
Yeah.
Hi. I'd like to ask, if a person does not show the antithyroid antibodies, but they've become dependent on replacement hormone, you know, if they've been on thyroid hormone products for a number of years, do you have success in weaning them off?
I mean, I never try and wean someone off of their medication. number one, I'm not a prescribing physician, so I can't tell someone to stop taking their medication.
Uh-huh.
That's a discussion that I have with their prescribing physician. And it really depends on how long they've been on thyroid hormone and how long they've had Hashimoto's. Obviously, the longer they've had Hashimoto's, the more destruction of the gland there is, and the more likely they're going to have to be on thyroid hormone.
Let's say they don't have Hashimoto's. My question was if they're not showing autoimmune antibodies.
Yeah, and if they don't have Hashimoto's, then they may or may not have to continue to take the medication. That's really an individual case, and it also depends on how long they've been on it.
Well, I find this an interesting question because, Dr. Heiberg, I find that a lot of people think that it's a bad thing to be on thyroid hormone, or they look at it as just a drug that they wish they didn't have to take. And I tend to look at it more like progesterone or something. Like you don't want to not have it in your body. A man wouldn't want to walk around with no testosterone, and I wouldn't want to walk around with my, you know, not enough thyroxin in my body. So, I mean, I know that I feel great on Armour's thyroid, and I've had, like, when I went out to Montana, I forgot to take it, and within 3-4 days, I was not myself, and anybody that hung out with me knew that. And,
yeah.
You know, playing with my hair, and there's hair falling out, and I'm irritable and all that stuff. So it's like, oh, I can't wait to get back on my thyroid. But I don't look at that as I'm addicted to it. I look at it as my body does really well on it, and it's probably not a great idea for me not to be on it.
Right. Yeah. No, let's clarify a few things. Number one, if someone needs thyroid hormone, then they need to be on it. And like Linda said, people really can be anti-thyroid hormone. You know, when your eyes go, then you have to wear glasses or you have to wear contacts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when the thyroid starts to go, you have to take hormone. I mean, you don't want to walk around blind and tired all the time.
That's a really good strategy.
Absolutely.
If you come to not
require it,
then you're lucky.
Yeah.
So it's
I'll give you an example. If someone develops just hypothyroidism and it's not autoimmune, and they developed it strictly because they were exposed to mega doses of mercury, and you get the mercury out of the body, then the thyroid may be able to return to normal and produce normal levels. Or if someone has a true iodine deficiency and they develop hypothyroidism and you replenish the iodine and the thyroid comes back to normally producing hormone, those are just some examples of where, yes, they might not have to take hormone every day for the rest of their lives. But not every case is that easy and that straightforward.
Yeah, I agree.
Do you see cases like that?
Occasionally, yes.
Okay. Okay, thanks.
There's hope for you. But I don't know why you hate taking it so much.
Oh, I don't.
It costs money. That's
worth
it.
I don't take it. It's just that it's a question that's occurred to me.
Yeah, I used to get asked that so much. So that's why I'm glad you brought that up.
Okay, thanks.
Go to the next question.
Here. That's great.
I have a question further about these stealth infections. Because we don't have good testing for sensitivity to many of them, how do you determine what your treatment is going to be and what have you found effective? Do you do any high-dose vitamin C or any IV therapies, or what do you do for these?
Right. So for the infections, I'm basically using different antimicrobials. Like I mentioned before, colloidal silver works really well for these. And then I just have a long list of herbs that I use, probably 25, 30 different herbs that work really well for different infections. I'll tell you some of the big guns for viruses are monolauric acid, or also called monolaurin. That works really well for chronic viruses. Olive leaf extract is really good. And then colloidal silver, those are kind of the big three I use for viruses. The parasites, you know, any of your general antimicrobials designed for the gut work really well, like the GI Microbex that Designs for Health has covers a lot of the bases there, and there's some other ones out there. You know, you could always, email me and I could send you a list of all the ones that I use. There's just so many, like Noni and Usnea Lichen and Sarsaparilla. I mean, there's just, again, it depends on the...
That would be great. Thank you. How quickly do you usually see a response?
Usually relatively quickly. If there's biofilm formation, then you also want to use enzymes for the biofilm, like
sure.
the natocerazyme, serapeptase, lumbrokinase, things like that. But if you get it right and you use one that the bug really doesn't like, then you usually see a response pretty quickly.
Okay, great. And then just one more question. Do you do much with the – we didn't hit much on the TH1 and TH2. Do you do much trying to balance those, you know, to stimulate the TH2 versus TH1?
Right. Yeah, I've learned all about that and did a little bit with it.
Mm-hmm.
But I've just – you know, you just find your own way of doing things, and that's certainly one way – to do it, but as you know, there's more than one way to get someone better, and you know, there's some people out there saying that you know their way is the best or their way is the only way.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't go into that, and quite frankly, I just haven't needed to get good results. Yeah. You could certainly do it and get good at it, and probably get good results as well.
Okay, great, thank you. Will your email, I guess, be announced then on the or published on the site, Linda?
I'm sorry, repeat? Oh, my cool. email?
Yeah, he mentioned
my
it was email.
It's just drhedberg@gmail.com, so it's drhedberg@gmail.com.
Great, thank you very much.
Sure.
And that reminds me, if anybody just has a comment or you want to recommend a speaker or you want, you know, just anything you want to ask, Designs for Health or... positive, negative, anything, doesn't matter. We're open to listening to all of you. We love you all. You can send an email to info@designsforhealth.com. So that's a basic information@designsforhealth.com so that person knows who to send it off to. They like a spider, send it out to whoever it should go to, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right, great audience tonight, and you had a record-breaking number of people on tonight, Dr. Hedberg. Close to 150. I'm very impressed. So
wow.
I think it's already 10:24, so I think we should quit. I'd like to let you go get some rest. So thank you so much. I don't know if you – did you pick the next question already? I'm sorry, Sam.
No, I had not, Linda.
Oh, okay. I thought I heard someone talking. All right. Well, thank you so much, everybody, for your participation. And get Dr. Hedberg's book, and patients should read it. It'll help them understand what's going on with their conditions, which so many of us have, including me. So thank you. Appreciate you being on tonight. You were great.
Thank you for having me, Linda. I really appreciate it.
That's great. No problem. And Sam, thanks for your help. And all of our listeners, you guys are great. And thanks for all the awesome questions. So join us next week. We should have Dr. Aaron Katz next week. He is Columbia University Director of Urology. Extremely well known. He'll be talking about a lot of different men's conditions, which we never get to talk about enough on clinical rounds. So urology, prostate cancer, all that good stuff, and nutrition. So join us next week. All right. Thank you, everybody. Good night.